Afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome you all to CSIS. My name is Alex Lennon. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Washington Quarterly here at CSIS, but I'm also a senior fellow in the International Security Program, and it's in that capacity that I've been running this project over the course of the last year or so. We're delighted to invite you all here and to be able to share the results of this year-long project with you. And the project is a result of many, many different people's work. We've handed out a policy brief as well as the report to all of you. And before I get into the substantive findings of our report, I'll sort of give you the first part of the project, and then Frank Fukuyama and Larry Diamond will talk about their papers that are part of the project. Mike McFaul was also in a role as a paper writer, and he, of course, is otherwise detained on the National Security Council right now, so wasn't able to join us. This is definitely the part of a lot of people's work. I really should, before I even get into the findings, thank three different sets of people. The first is the advisory committee, which you have listed on the front of your policy brief. This is a set of people that we combined, and we have a couple of the members here, not just the two people sitting next to me up here, but also Liz Dugan and Mark Palmer, who I saw come in. I know there are a couple others that are coming at some point during the session that I didn't quite see. I have to thank them as a combination of people, both democracy experts and general foreign policy thinkers. We had three sets of extremely interesting discussions that helped review some of the drafts of the papers that are in this report and improve all of them. The second set of people are the two brainiacs sitting to my right, as well as Mike himself, who took it upon themselves in incredibly busy schedules in both of their cases and in Mike's case as well, in some cases during the heat of the campaign season last year when we were doing this project, to take on this role and really flesh out some alternative strategies for how to look at the role of democracy in U.S. security strategy. And then the third set of people, who is the part that I'll be talking about, is the first part of this project. And the first part of this project is a set of interviews that we did with about 40 different folks. It ranged from undersecretaries of state for political affairs, policy planning directors, from people that are have never served in government or have served in former governments. We had both people that were in the previous government, people that have gone into the current government, people that have never served in government at all, or people that served prior to the last administration. So we really felt like we got a good sampling, certainly not comprehensive, but a good sampling of views, particularly from the security community. Again, I think you can take a look from that list that's on the back page of the policy brief. We did certainly include some democracy experts, including some of the people in this room. But the principal focus was to use them as a sanity check on the types of questions that we were asking and whether they were commensurate with the findings of the security and foreign policy community more broadly. In other words, people that thought about not just democracy issues, but proliferation, terrorism, and a range of other things before we walked into the room to talk to them for about 30 to 75 minutes each. All of those interviews were conducted from June to November of last year. So again, during the campaign season, in part before it was clear who the new president was going to be. The sets of questions that what I'll talk about in the first 10 to 15 minutes of the findings before turning it over to Larry and Frank are the three sets of questions you have here. The first was a sense of why the strategic community believes, if at all, that the spread of democracy is important to U.S. strategic interests. The second on what the U.S. government's role should be going forward. And the third is to begin to try and touch on how democracy should be supported. But on that last question, we really relied more in the project on the three papers that were written that we'll talk about subsequently. The quotes at the top are all predictably sort of representative samples of some of the quotes that were told to us directly. What surprised us in some ways was how consistent the strategic community's belief in the interest of the spread of democracy. The issue here is not whether the U.S. government is the principal agent in spreading democracy, but whether the spread of democracy is in the U.S. strategic interests, not for necessarily moral or normative reasons, although some people cited those, but for the strategic interests of the United States. Does the strategic community believe, after the first two post-Cold War U.S. administrations, that the spread of democracy is in the United States' interest? The answer was, without exception, yes, but possibly for reasons that might differ from what you'd expect. And I have to really thank Ashley Tellus, among other advisory committee members, for pushing us to ask these questions and push some of the interviews on them. The principal place that people started was what academics would call a sense of American identity. It may not be clear to some that the role of democracy in U.S. security strategy predates the Bush administration by a long shot. It was one of the three central pillars of the Clinton administration's strategy of engagement and enlargement. And you have in the appendix of your book a series of presidential speeches that go back to FDR, to Woodrow Wilson, and arguably all the way back to the concept of the United States as a shining city on the hill, to the founding fathers themselves in some elements of that notion or that conception. But the strategic interest went beyond that. There were a number of people that cited being, quote, card-carrying members of the Kantian Club, of being believers in at least a mild version of the democratic peace theory, or the idea that the world would be a more peaceful and prosperous place if there were more democracies in the world. There were certainly a couple that raised the question of how you get from here to there, and democratic transitions and whether those are stable or not. But they probably appeared in fewer interviews than you might think, and a number of people cited initially in the interviews that we conducted with them a sense of at least a mild version over the long term in a general sense that democracies are less likely to fight with each other. The second strategic reason is a number of people citing that democracies make better and more sustainable decisions, that they make better allies for the United States, or that they're more likely to be cooperative members of an emerging or an international order that needs to be built over a period of time. The basic conception here was that if you were going to have an international society that follows rules and the rule of law, having domestic societies that are built on those principles as well are more likely to have states that abide by those international or will build those international rules over a period of time. The third strategic reason that we found was cited was that the United States, to regain its image as a benevolent power in the world, it would be beneficial for the United States to help other countries construct democracies, to build self-governing societies as they see that they want to build them, and to be an asset to those indigenous movements themselves. The idea here, I think, is cited in the policy brief as well by Zbigniew Brzezinski and others that talk about sort of this idea of the United States as a benevolent power, or one that will raise fewer concerns about what the United States will do with its power if it's clear that it is to help other countries build democracies in ways that they see fit for their own governance. The final aspect here that's worth mentioning is just the number of people in the strategic interviews we did that said democracy is a part of U.S. grand strategy. Now, what that U.S. grand strategy is varied from person to person. Some cited building modernity. Some cited building responsible sovereign states that follow international rules. Some cited cooperative order that would build those international rules in the first place. And that democracy was a means to that end, although not necessarily the central animating principle of U.S. foreign policy in the next or now current or Obama administration. The questions then turn to what should the U.S. government's role be? And here there were sort of seven lessons learned that we derived from the discussions. The first three were all don'ts or things to avoid, and they were all based on recent sort of evidence. In all cases, we asked these questions over the last two administrations in an attempt to sort of define this question in a post-Cold War world where you didn't have the Soviet Union as a natural balance or counterpart to the United States, what the lessons learned were. In most cases in the interview, they quickly turned to the last administration for obvious reasons and I think just for proximity, if nothing else. I want to phrase these three very carefully because the lessons as they are, you know, the space that's allowable for a bullet point doesn't really give the complexity of the lessons learned, although they're elaborated in the paper that you have in the report. The first is Iraq. Almost every single person we talked to said, do not misunderstand this. The reason we went into Iraq in the first place was not about spreading democracy. It was a natural evolution of a decision to overturn Saddam Hussein. Remember, these are people who think about proliferation and terrorism issues for the most part as much as, if not, and in most cases, more than democracy issues. And the answer was, we went into Iraq because of faulty intelligence about weapons of mass destruction, principally. That included people coming out of the administration that made this argument. But once the decision was made to overturn Saddam Hussein, it was an inevitable conclusion that what you replaced it with was going to be a democracy if the United States was involved. And it was certainly used as a justification for the intervention in Iraq after the fact, particularly after weapons of mass destruction have not been found, and in common perception has been more frequently associated with the principal reason why the United States went in the first place. Most of the people that we interviewed, I believe, would call that revisionist history. That wasn't the original the impetus for going in. However, the lesson that's being drawn is using military force to build democracies is not an effective way to facilitate democracy. In fact, more broadly than that, using coercion, including economic sanctions, to facilitate the spread of democracy is not an effective way to spread democracy. a number of people that we talked to said, for domestic consumption and for reasons to be seen as trying to do something, you may impose economic sanctions. But they had little to no reason to believe that they actually made a difference in the country that was the target of those sanctions themselves, once you got to that point where there was a crisis in the country itself. What might be termed sort of the baby in the bathwater of the Bush administration or the outgoing administration, most people that we interviewed, I think, would cite the Millennium Challenge account. The idea here was that there may be differences on the specific criteria that was used, the amount of assistance that was being given through the Millennium Challenge account, the countries that were targets of the Millennium Challenge account, but the idea was that using foreign assistance as a strategy to help build democracies and help consolidate democracies in particular was one of the things that should be maintained, including someone associated with the Democratic Party that said they think it should be the basis for our democracy policy going forward. That is the principal sort of takeaway that was by most members of the strategic community that we spoke to. The second don't or thing to be careful of is derived from the Palestinian elections in January of 2006 and Hamas's victory in those elections. I want to be very careful here about phrasing the lesson that was taken away. Every person in the democracy community is ready to beat my head against a wall whenever I raised the implication that the democracy community thinks elections are equated with democracy. It was unbelievable how violent some of the reactions I got from some of these people, to the point where I didn't really feel physically threatened, but they certainly invented new shades of Crayola colors in talking about this issue and how much frustration there was about it. The argument here in the strategic community is that, and I think what we found in the academic literature that's concurrent with this, the idea of the role in building democracy has been whittled down over the course of the past two decades or so. And if you look at some of the academic literature in the early 90s to what some would call thin democracy or what some at the time called low-intensity democracy, there was an equation of an American comparative advantage or niche capability in helping monitor elections that, to some extent in the strategic community, had narrowed or denuanced the conception of democracy and all of its complications. The Palestinian elections re-raised all of those nuances and those complications and opened all of the different elements that are involved in democracy to the point where the strategic community is talking about elections being held too early, that you need a certain amount of political culture in these countries, certain institutional developments, and either a quantum theory of democracy development or even in one or two cases the argument that elections may be toward the latter stages of a democratization process rather than one of the earlier ones. And Frank's paper in particular, as well as Larry's, elaborate on this. The third principle don't that was taken away from this is, frankly, the principal lesson that the strategic community is deriving from. The lessons the strategic community thinks about do not start with Iraq. They start with Egypt. They start with U.S. policy in Egypt in 2005 and 2006, and the appearance of a U.S. policy that put a tremendous amount of rhetorical emphasis on spreading democracy, particularly in the second inaugural address in 2005, that then at least publicly, with our allies, in places like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan, was perceived to not put much emphasis on the issue in those public interactions with those countries. Now, people inside the administration will be the first ones to tell you it is incredibly frustrating because dealing with our allies and calling them out in public is not necessarily the best way to get this done. But when you are outside the government, being able to see what actions they take and the appearance of hypocrisy and subsequent loss of credibility in the United States is the principal lesson and challenge that those in the strategic community on both sides of the political aisle are taken away from the lessons of the last administration. It doesn't start with Iraq. It starts with Egypt. The last four lessons or things to do are, frankly, not worth going into as much detail because they are somewhat common to the criticism of U.S. of recent administration's foreign policy. This shouldn't surprise people. If the last administration defined the center of its foreign policy as democracy promotion, whatever criticism you have of the last administration's foreign policy is the criticism you are likely to have of their democracy promotion policy. So the idea that the current administration needs to be more patient, needs to be more humble, both about the extent of U.S. power generally and specifically on this form of social engineering and the difficulty of setting up other systems of governance outside of the United States, of any country, particularly when it's the United States being involved, of being more cooperative, in this case, in democracy, of working with a range of non-governmental organizations, partner governments, multilateral organizations at both the regional level, like the AU and the OAS, or the global level, like the UN, and ultimately of being more pragmatic, of appearing to be less ideological about the issue. The only thing worth mentioning on this last element is it is not limited to the argument that the United States has other interests like proliferation and terrorism which may in the near term trump democracy. The reasons why the United States may be accused of hypocrisy are more complex than that. They range from the different needs across a variety of countries, within different regions, and across different regions. So the idea that the United States is going to appear consistent in what it does in any different country, much less region of the world, is almost impossible. And so there will always be a certain vulnerability to the United States being accused of doing things differently in one area to another, because frankly, if it's going to be successful, they will have to do things differently from one area to another. The idea is also that the U.S., frankly, has different amounts of influence in these other countries and different ways of leveraging it. What you do with one country publicly may be effective. If you do it publicly in a country that has a strong nationalist anti-American strain, you are likely, in many cases, to cause the target regime to dig in, and you would be more effective at working behind the scenes or privately. So the manner in which you can more effectively leverage American power is going to vary from place to place and needs to be integrated into what Secretary Clinton in her confirmation hearing talked about as smart power, or being more nuanced in the ways that it uses U.S. leverage, not just in democracy policy, but more broadly. The last elements are the how-to. I'll turn most of the discussion over to Frank and to Larry because their papers really go much more depth than what we did. What we could draw out from the interviews was a couple of touchstone principles upon which people developed. The one thing that I will emphasize and that we focused the interviews on was the public diplomacy framework for a new administration, and at that point it wasn't clear whether it was Obama or McCain, upon which or under which it could build country-specific and region-specific strategies that would vary from place to place. The question we asked was, is democracy promotion the right phrase for a new administration to use in this area, or has it become so toxic that it has become counterproductive? The answer almost universally was, it's become so toxic that it's counterproductive. But the focus of the phrase democracy promotion surprised at least me in the word that is conveying the problem. In the discussion of democracy, in about half of the interviews that we conducted, people looked for different alternatives that ranged from things consistent with the Princeton Project's findings on forging a world of liberty under law, on freedom as an alternative word, on what Phil Zelikow wrote in The American Interest as an open and civilized world as an alternative word. The problem is that the range of alternatives that people experimented with vary from interview to interview. There was almost no case where more than one person suggested the same alternative. So there's this vast experimentation going around in about half of that strategic communities. In the other half of the interviews, people said, the problem isn't with democracy. It needs to be rehabilitated, clarified, unpacked in its complexity so we get away from this misconception that it is equated with elections. And that is something that a new administration and a new face on the administration has an opportunity to redefine at some point, particularly early in the administration. And there are different elements of how those nuances can be unpacked. In every interview we conducted but two, when the word promotion was asked, everybody said, we have got to lose it. In about half of the interviews, people suggested support as an alternative. A couple thought about assistance, but others said that's too economics. It's more complex than just economic assistance. A couple thought about nurturing. That didn't really sit with a number of people, particularly some that had a little bit more military experience in other places. It was a bit too touchy-feely for them. But when we said, does support do the word for you, if it wasn't one they suggested, they said, yeah, that works. And the idea that you could convey these senses of cooperation, of patience, of humility, and of pragmatism all worked with support in a way that changing from democracy promotion to democracy support would work more effectively. There are, in the policy brief that you have, five pillars for the elements of democracy support. The way to conceptualize this, for those that are into metaphors, may be that if the tent of American public diplomacy is to change the phrase to democracy support, there are pillars under that tent upon which you actually begin to implement these principles of humility, patience, cooperation, and pragmatism. There were five of those, and three of them came up in the interviews, and the others were ones that were developed in the papers. I'll turn to Larry in 60 seconds just to talk about his framework paper that really gets at those elements of support. The ones that came up in the interviews that supported the papers in particular, were the idea of the United States returning to being a shining city on the hill. In almost every interview, the words Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, torture, rendition came up. The argument is that the process of resolving these complicated post-9/11 issues need to be transparent. It is less about the outcome and more about the process of being seen as a democratic way of resolving these challenges, as to how to go about doing it. The second one that came up was what I mentioned before. In American public diplomacy, the United States should be more pragmatic and acknowledge that its strategies will differ from place to place around the world, particularly at the top political levels of the administration, and they can be even more nuanced at the region or country-specific levels when you start getting down to assistant secretary of states, ambassadors, and people that have more specific responsibilities. And finally, the thing that came up in the interviews is concordant with both of these two papers, is to use economic assistance both to facilitate the long-term trends for democratization in a way that people know the sort of traditional argument that economic decentralization and development leads to political decentralization and liberalization, but more specifically the idea that you can use economic assistance to help governments, particularly nascent democratic governments, deliver the food, education, services that the people most adamantly desire. And unless democracies deliver those goods and services to those people, democracy as a form of government is not going to last very long in those countries. And we need, as a government, to begin to implement those forms of assistance through our economic policy in ways that Frank talks about in his paper. I'm going to turn to Larry first to discuss in greater detail the first his paper over the next 12 to 15 minutes, and then turn to Frank, and then we'll open it to question and answer after that. Larry, over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Alex. And thank you, CSIS, for organizing this project at this extremely important, possibly historic, certainly worrisome and consequential moment in our history and in the history of what some have called the third wave of democratization, if we even think that that is still something that is alive. My thesis follows quite naturally from what Alex has just laid out. And in a way, there's a kind of artificial division of labor here. The different papers in this project certainly overlap with one another. And in a way, a kind of artificial pushing of my perspective into a particular box. I want to begin by saying that my emphasis on a new strategy of supporting democracy, where it already exists and is in deep trouble, does not preclude and should not prevent our working to bring about democratic change elsewhere in the world. But for the reasons that the project and Alex have laid out so clearly, I think that is something that we should do with a little bit lower profile, and it should be something we do with the recognition that we are in very grave danger of losing many of the democratic gains we have made in the last three decades. Here are the factors, briefly, that I think militate toward a reshaping of our democracy strategy in the world toward more of a democracy support strategy. One is the reaction against the what is widely seen from our interviews, but you know, from any kind of sort of surveying of public reactions, what is seen as perhaps a bit of rhetorical and political overreach on the part of President Bush. Some people use the word imperial. I don't want to get into motives. I actually think President Bush had sincere and very lofty ideals that motivated his efforts here. But there is a kind of global and domestic reaction against the way it was framed. And I think a shared feeling that some kind of new and in some ways more subtle approach is needed. Secondly, and this is the thing that primarily preoccupies me, I think there was, well before the world fell into what will clearly be the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, and which we still at this moment do not know whether it will become another depression, there was evidence of a gathering democratic recession in the world. I don't have time to lay out the reasons why I think this is happening empirically. I'll just make one point to you that there have been 25 by now, one could possibly say, 26 reversals of democracy since the third wave began in 1974, and two-thirds of these have happened in the last decade. And if you look at the new Freedom House survey of freedom in the world and study the trends in a lot of particular countries, you see that we are, you know, we're in a period of gathering danger that is the result of accumulated problems of bad governance and bad performance, which then gets into the issues that preoccupy Frank, of many of the new democracies that have emerged during the last 2 to 3 decades. You have chronic problems of corruption, clientelism, patronage-soaked politics that really are standing in the way of just and sustainable development, extremely weak, porous political institutions that could be seen as amounting to what Tom Carruthers once called in the pages of our Journal of Democracy, feckless democracy. Democracy just not functioning well, beginning to lose popular faith and support. I don't think it's hemorrhaging yet in most places, but there are signs of erosion. Persistent poverty that really hasn't been cracked in most places, although there are promising programs that Frank addresses in his paper. And all of this, I repeat, before the world began to fall into a vicious downward economic spiral, the bottom of which we haven't even begun to see yet in global terms, which will deeply, acutely challenge, I think, in ways that may, may mimic some of the challenges of the interwar period in the early 20th century, deeply challenge new, partial, and unstable, weakly institutionalized, and insecurely legitimated democracies. So we need a strategy to shore them up. That is our highest strategic imperative. If we see the breakdown, which is quite conceivable in my view, of many of these existing democracies in the next few years, particularly in the wake of this spreading economic crisis, it will be a disaster for the fate of democracy, freedom, and human rights in the world. I think it will be very, very bad for American national security, and it will not be a favorable context in which other new democracies can break through, emerge, and take root. It'll be a climate in which democracy is slipping backwards and not moving forwards. Now, what does this mean in terms of specifics about a democracy strategy? I'm not going to repeat what Alex said because there's no need to. You just heard it. But let me just say some of the things that are more specific to my paper, if I may. First of all, I think that we need to not only sustain but increase political assistance for democratic development. That is democracies, what is called in USAID democracy and governance assistance, and all of the assistance that is flowing through the family of institutions that is the National Endowment for Democracy, and that flows through a number of other non-governmental organizations as well. You know, I deal with a lot of civil society actors around the world, and of course what I'm about to say will sound, from their standpoint, extremely self-interested. But I've been on the ground in some of these places. I've engaged them. I've seen the work they're doing. And they will tell you, and I believe from my own research and empirical experience, that despite the explosion of democracy assistance globally in the last 10 to 20 years, and certainly in the budgets that we have in the United States, there still is not enough resources to fund everything that is needed, and that would help to strengthen and institutionalize and deepen democracy around the world. This doesn't mean that there aren't actors who are not who are getting resources, who aren't utilizing them effectively. There are. It doesn't mean that we don't need more effective monitoring and oversight. We do, but I want to stress that requires resources as well. And I don't think there are enough resources going into that. But there are many courageous, deserving, and necessary actors, both in civil society and potentially in the state sector and in the political party arena, who are doing the hard labor of trying to build, deepen, improve, monitor, constrain, discipline, make work better new and fragile democracies. And the democracy and governance program of USAID should not have to scratch its head in frustration, thinking how they're going to get enough money to the 24 or so emerging democracies of sub-Saharan Africa to support these institutions and official processes, because three-quarters of their budget is going to four countries, three of them being non-democratic. It doesn't make sense. Part of it is a matter of priorities, but part of it is a matter of more resources. Now, I think this implies, it's a very painful and difficult thing to say in the current budgetary climate, that President Obama was right in his campaign when he called for very substantially increasing and indeed, in his view, doubling U.S. Foreign assistance. Not that that's going to happen in the next year or two. For me, and I'll let Frank speak to the economic dimensions of this, for me, it also means that if we have to choose, I actually think that democracy and governance assistance, increasing it, is the most important component of our development assistance, because if you don't get the institutions right in terms of state, political system, and civil society, to deliver a more effective, more accountable, more inclusive, and representative governance, then all of the other money we are spending to try and relieve poverty, reduce human misery, improve human well-being is at risk of not being spent effectively. And I really think that while it would be superficial and specious to say that if you just fix governance, everything else will follow, that without fixing governance, nothing else can follow. And I think this has been one of the fundamental failings of the development assistance efforts in the world and the development assistance community in the world and the development assistance multilateral institutions in the world, not least the World Bank, for a long time. Secondly, and I think it follows from what I've said, that we need a much more focused, integrated set of efforts to combat corruption and bad governance. There are many innovative ideas and efforts that are bubbling up from experience, from practitioners in this business, and from civil society on how we can produce more grassroots efforts, more incentive-based efforts at accountability and monitoring of what government does and of development assistance flows. But we also have to work on the formal institutions. We cannot turn the corner on this problem without a national context in which there is freedom of the press, freedom of organization, and freedom of society to scrutinize what government does. Now, I'll leave aside for a moment the question of democratic elections. I don't think that's always essential for what I'm talking about right now in the immediate context. But if you have freedom of the press and freedom of organization, people are going to use them to demand free and fair elections. We also need much more rigorous institutions of what is called in the literature horizontal accountability, counter-corruption commissions, audit commissions, ombudsmen, legislative committees that are independent of executive control, insulated from political manipulation, intimidation, and interference, have high esprit de corps, training, morale, recruitment of personnel, and so on. Now, I think building up these dimensions, both societal accountability and horizontal accountability, of a more concerted effort to combat and contain corruption and therefore get better, more effective, and accountable governance should rise on the agenda to become one of the highest elements of what we do to foster development and democracy, with a particular focus on trying to improve the functioning of those democracies that come into being. But I think we also have to take the next step to set standards and, if you will, draw conditions. And that brings me to reforming foreign assistance. I'm very proud to be a member of this network, Modernizing Foreign Assistance, MFAN, that is seeking to upgrade, empower, enhance, and enlarge, and God help us, rationalize our disparate foreign assistance efforts. And I certainly applaud Congressman Berman and the House Foreign Affairs Committee in what appears to be now a historic effort to rewrite the Foreign Assistance Act. I think much of what has been proposed is compelling and necessary, but we also need, I know, Alex, I'm coming to the conclusion here. I've been a chair, so I know what's on your mind. We need to take the selectivity principles in the Millennium Challenge account and inject them more. I'm not saying that all of American foreign assistance should look like the Millennium Challenge account, but this is a huge, exciting new departure. I personally think it's the single best thing that President Bush did in foreign and international affairs, and I hope it won't be allowed to kind of quietly shrivel up just kind of as a partisan backlash against the last administration. It's a good idea. It needs more effort. It needs fine-tuning in terms of the selectivity process, and it needs to be the approach needs to be injected into our development assistance more generally. One tweaking that I think is necessary there is countries now, when they are evaluated on the MCA standards, are graded on a curve. They're just compared to all the others. And I think certain things should not be graded on a curve. We can ask every country that would get these substantial new increments of development assistance to allow press freedom and organizational freedom as some of the criteria for qualifying for this assistance, and to have in place or commit to putting in place the independent institutions of horizontal accountability, truly insulated from political control, that would provide a good prospect of reducing corruption and abuse of power. And then if they commit to doing this, we can help defunding it. I have a number of points to make about poverty reduction, but Frank speaks to that. I've talked about increasing aid, about regional and international cooperation. Maybe I'll just close with this point. I think that this is a time when there's more readiness on the part of the United States to try and do some of these things in partnership with the international community. And there's also, surprising, it's not being reported very much, more currents of opportunity for this. The United Nations is now undergoing a very intriguing process of trying to craft its own strategy for what it can do to enhance rule of law and enhance democracy. I think there are very significant opportunities to work with the UN now. And there is something called the United Nations Democracy Fund, which is partially funded by the U.S., partly by India, partly by other donors, which is working to offer grants to support democratic development around the world. This seems to me to be not the time when the UN is finally doing what we, many of us, wish it had been doing for 20 years, not the time to be allowing that fund to shrivel up and wither. And the budget proposal for the U.S. Congress in terms of the American contribution to this fund now envisions something like an 80% cut in American contributions to that fund. And I think that would be a tragic mistake. There are things we can do. We've written about this. The Committee for a Community of Democracies recently has, to President Obama, to strengthen and revitalize the community of democracies. And that as well, I think, would give new energy and legitimacy to the efforts to strengthen and improve the actual functioning of the existing democracies of the world. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. Let me turn it over to Frank for the development assistance.
Well, as Larry said, the division of labor between him and Mike and me on this project is a little bit artificial, and I think we largely agree on ways that you can reposition democracy promotion. But I guess I'll come at it in a little bit different manner. The insight that I had about why you needed to approach this differently came to me when I was in Caracas a couple of years ago, two or three months before the last election that brought Hugo Chavez, got him reelected as president of Venezuela. And when I was there, I met with virtually all of the political opponents of Chavez that were the people that were running against him or aspiring to run against him at the home of one of the party institutes, local office in Venezuela. And I talked to all of them, and they were talking about their strategies for contesting that election. And after they left, that the institute representative turned to me, and he shook his head. He said, "These guys are really hopeless, because they do not have a social agenda that will appeal to poor people in Venezuela. You know, they're all middle class, they're all well educated, they're in favor of free trade and political democracy, but there's no reason why any poor person in Venezuela should prefer them." And they're kind of tagging along and saying, "Me too," with the very popular social programs that Chavez started, but they really have absolutely nothing to offer. And this started me thinking about where democracy promotion fits in the larger scheme of development. It comes naturally to me in my current position, since I'm running an international development program at SAIS, and I actually spend a lot of time at the World Bank and at the Inter-American Development Bank and at institutions that don't do democracy promotion but do development, and to think a little bit about how this fits into this larger context. And so in the paper that I wrote for this project, it begins with a fairly, shall we say, academic treatment of the different dimensions of democracy. But it's important because you need to put democracy promotion into this proper context in order to come up with sensible strategies. So I think there's really five dimensions of development. There's economic development, which is what most development economists spend all of their time thinking about, per capita increases in output in poor countries. There's social development, which really has to do with the mobilization of new groups, their organization into civil society so that they can actually participate in a political process as a result of modernization more broadly. And then political development really has three distinct components. The first of it is state building, which is simply the accumulation of power on the part of a government that allows it to enforce laws and rules within its territory, in the classic Weberian, you know, definition of what a state is. And all of this involves the concentration and ability to deploy power. The fourth dimension, the second political dimension, is rule of law, which, contrary to state building, reduces the power or limits the power, particularly of executive agencies in states, and makes it subject to a law that is higher than the sovereign authority in that society. And then finally, there is democracy, which is a form of accountability, which, again, like rule of law, limits the power of states to do what they want and makes sure that that power is used in ways that are approved by some kind of a popular consensus. And in the paper I review, there's a lot of academic research about how these different dimensions of development are all related to each other. I believe, as a normative matter, that they are all important and worthy goals in themselves, and any overall development has to involve all five of those dimensions. But we do know something about how they interrelate. So, for example, state building. We just had a little session commemorating Sam Huntington at the NED yesterday. But Huntington, you know, pointed out that if you don't have basic political order guaranteed by a state, you're not going to have any of the other dimensions there as well. And if you don't believe me, you know, go to Somalia. Rule of law similarly has been seen by many economists, you know, property rights, commercial code, ability to adjudicate property rights disputes as critical to any form of long-term investment and therefore long-term economic growth. Social development, mobilization of civil society, creation of an extensive division of labor based on an industrial economy is very critical to democracy because that's what brings new players that demand their, you know, rights to be heard in the political space to the fore. Democracy is not always necessarily conducive to economic growth. We know some good performers and we know some bad performers, and there are countries like India that were at one time were bad performers and another time became good performers, being democratic under both circumstances. But it is also the case that there are times when democracy actually is a key to good governance and therefore to economic growth, as Larry said, because if you don't have populations that are sufficiently mobilized through a democratic process to hold corrupt or ineffective governments to account and change the leaders that behave that way, then it's very hard to see how the leaders are going to have much of an incentive to, you know, to fix their own behavior. Now, the fact that all of these are separate dimensions of development and one can lead to another oftentimes leads to sequencing arguments, the most famous of which was initially articulated by Sam Huntington, something known as the authoritarian transition, where you want all of these good things eventually, but because you know that state building and rule of law are necessary conditions for economic development and that economic development tends to support the emergence of democracy, you do those things first and you put off the democracy till later. And that is, in fact, exactly the strategy that was followed by South Korea, Taiwan, and so forth. I don't know whether China and Singapore were actually following that strategy. They just like being authoritarian, but they certainly were able to achieve a high level of capitalist economic development, having a coherent state and bureaucracy and incipient rule of law, which was sufficient to get economic growth kicked off. And then, you know, the idea is that once you get rich, you can begin to afford democracy. Now, I am not making an argument in favor of sequencing. I think Tom Carruthers in the Journal of Democracy last year had a kind of what I would regard as the last word about this, in many respects, that sequencing works in a very limited number of cases, almost all of them, for cultural reasons, I believe, happen in East Asia. Of course, if you can get a Lee Kuan Yew that is going to get your country to grow at, you know, 10% a year. Okay, you can ride that horse, but I don't see many Lee Kuan Yews in Asia, I mean in the Middle East or Latin America or Africa. And so I just think it's not a terribly a sensible strategy. On the other hand, it is very sensible, as Larry has suggested, to think about all of these other dimensions of development in the context of consolidating the regimes of new and fragile democracies, because for all of the reasons he said, the backsliding occurs because they are not delivering on the promise. You have an election, people think that democracy is going to actually make their lives better, but in so many cases it doesn't make a damn bit of difference because it doesn't actually deliver on any of the goods, you know, and just basic public goods like security, schools, education, things that, that people really care about. And part of the backlash against the third wave has been on the part of populists that have been able to attack democratic regimes and our, you know, liberal friends all over the world because they have ignored this agenda. So I think that it is really important to put democracy, what do we call it, democracy support, in the context of a broader development agenda in which people worry, rightly about the things like free and fair elections and political party development. That all very much remains on the agenda, but these political parties have to have something to do once they get into power that connects them with these broader, especially with poor populations that we have not typically been able to connect with terribly well, but that Hamas, Hezbollah, Chavez, Morales, all these people are able to connect with better. And I think if we can do that, it then actually helps not just consolidate democracy, but as Larry said, it also helps with economic development and other things. Now, in particular, I think that we I need to clarify who the we is here. So the we means the United States, and this does not necessarily mean the democracy promotion community itself, but the United States needs to think about how you implement a more of a social agenda in its development assistance programs. I think that for the last 30 years, because we have not had any real innovative social policy in the United States, we've been pretty much brain dead on this subject. And we don't have much to offer developing countries, therefore, in programs that help, you know, in health. And, well, health is a little bit different because there's been a lot of money given to specific diseases like HIV, AIDS, and so forth. But, you know, in a broader sense, you know, how do you fix the healthcare system of a poor country? How do you improve the educational performance of a public secular school system in Egypt or a Pakistan or places like this? And I think that there are some innovative ideas out there. A lot of them actually have not been American ideas, but they've been developed indigenously, so that in Latin America you've had a number of very interesting conditional cash transfer programs that put money in the hands of poor families on the condition that they send their children to school, which has actually been quite successful in raising school attendance rates in Mexico and Brazil and other places where this sort of thing has been tried. Education reform is a much tougher nut to crack because that's a deeply political kind of approach. But nonetheless, if you don't actually deliver better primary and secondary education in these countries, you know, people are going to go to madrasas or they're going to be attracted to parties that actually, and that's what's interesting about all this class of new populists is these don't just advocate that the government give out these social services. They actually deliver the social services directly. They run, you know, eye clinics or they run schools or they run healthcare facilities and the like. And so I think that at least as far as what the democracy promotion community can do, it needs to be more aware of what can be offered in terms of a policy agenda for new democratic parties that want to consolidate their rule, expand their political base, you know, those parties that are truly committed to having democracy in their countries. I think back in Washington, what we need to do is recognize actually that there is a de facto, enormous de facto overlap between what people in the development community have been doing and what people in the democracy promotion community have been doing, because a lot of people in development have recognized that you don't actually have development without good governance, and you don't have good governance without a fair amount of grassroots pressure for better performance on the part of mobilized civil society. And so it's been this funny experience where, you know, at the World Bank, they've got these initiatives that are under title rubrics like, you know, building demand for good governance, which actually is identical to civil society support that this democracy promotion community has been doing, except that the people at the bank have never heard of, you know, the NED or IRI or NDI or any of these organizations that actually do this kind of thing. And conversely, people in the democracy promotion community are really not familiar with things like the National Solidarity Program or the Kajimatan Development Program in Afghanistan and Indonesia, by which development institutions actually go out on a village level and try to organize, in effect, local civil society. So how to implement this all, this then becomes this incredible inside baseball kind of Washington talk as to, you know, at what level, if you want to integrate these different dimensions, how do you do it? You know, my own preference, I think, like Larry's, is actually not to integrate development and AID further into U.S. foreign policy. I mean, I know that development serves the interests of U.S. foreign policy, but I think the more distance, the more apparent distance you can put between the parts of the U.S. government that promote development, including democratic development, and the State Department and the Pentagon, I think the better. On the other hand, within the development community, there needs to be much better integration across these different dimensions of development. And how specifically you do that, I think, is a kind of technical issue that we need to have a, you know, long discussion about, because I don't think actually you want people that are good at organizing elections to be handing out condoms or, you know, kind of setting up HIV/AIDS clinics and this sort of thing. But there needs at a country or a region level somebody that can think about how you deliver a balanced set of assistance that is not simply political, nor simply economic, nor simply social. Thank you.
Thanks. We have a little bit of time for questions and hopefully answers, at least for questions. We have two standing mics at the front. If I can ask people to come up toward them, and we'll sort of take them in line that way. If you can briefly identify yourself by name and your institution, we'd appreciate it. And if you could keep the questions brief so that others have a chance to address them. I've promised Larry that he will be out of here promptly at 3:30 because he has a plane to catch. So we will have to end on time, so if you can keep the questions short, I'd appreciate it. Okay. Let me start with Stan.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. On Hamas and elections, during the Iran-Contra hearings, Warren Rudman lectured Oliver North, the American people have the right to be wrong. That's what popular sovereignty means. Since nobody can be right all the time, the question of sovereignty rests with those who have the right to be wrong. We don't approve of Hamas. I don't approve of Hamas. But do the Palestinian people have the right to be wrong? You know, how can you have democracy without elections? Elections by themselves do not mean democracy. There are other elements that are necessary. But how do you have democracy without elections? And how do you address this question of whether the people have the right to be wrong?
Why don't we do three at a time, just because there's nine people and I divide. So let's go this way.
Hilton Hurt, George Mason University. I'd like to congratulate the research team. These essays clearly exhibit great wisdom and experience. I do have a question concerning the realism of the views with regard to U.S. interventions and U.S. role. There seems to be a presumption that the U.S. democracy promotion is a large part of U.S. overall intervention. This is really not realistic. Most U.S. aid is tied to strategic objectives. The majority of it goes, as Larry said, to three or four countries that align with us politically. It's viewed in many people, I mean by many people around the world, to be a form of bribery. The real question is how to liberate the decisions of where we intervene financially so that some of the objectives that are being defined here can be met.
My name is Ashraf Haideri. I'm the political counselor at the Afghan embassy here in Washington. The question is for both speakers, and I think Mr. Fukufa Maya touched on one of the key projects in Afghanistan. The question is, of course, over the past decade or so, the Afghan people have been, I think, one of the few nations that has been demanding democracy. And I think upon international re-engagement in the country, there were, you know, voices that these people are backward, of course, they're illiterate, they've been at war, and they will not embrace democracy. But we did. 80% of the Afghans, you know, registered to vote, and they elected President Karzai. So the question is, going from this point forward, as this administration is reviewing its strategy towards Afghanistan, what set of policy recommendations do you have for this administration to pursue an Afghanistan in the following, say, decade or so? Thank you.
Okay, well, Stan, yes, I do think people have the right to be wrong. I mean, how you deal with Hamas is obviously pretty, you know, tricky, because they also want the destruction of a close, you know, ally of ours. But I think that the solution is not by pretending that they don't exist, because ultimately, you know, if you're going to have a settlement of, you know, of that conflict, it has to be one that you know, the parties buy into. I don't think you can dodge this by having a, you know, unrepresentative PA that doesn't actually somehow reflect the interests of, you know, actually the Palestinian people. But how you bring that about, I don't know. I'll let Larry handle Hilton's on the
thank you so much.
Yeah, on the Afghan question. Yeah, I've been watching, you know, these suggestions on the part of the Obama administration that they somehow pull back and concentrate just on the military part of the assistance. What I'm hoping is that this is more directed towards American audiences as a means of getting them to lower their expectations, but it actually doesn't reflect what they intend to do in Afghanistan, because if so, it's crazy. Because I don't think that you can fight the military part of the counterinsurgency struggle in Afghanistan unless you pay attention to the nation building, development, democracy parts of it. You know, you're just not going to get Afghans to buy into it. And so I think that you can't drop that part of the agenda. You got to do more of that stuff. So like I said, my hopeful interpretation of this is that this is just meant for American audiences as a means of, you know, trying to tell them, well, maybe, you know, we're not as ambitious, you know, don't expect as much as the last administration.
On the broader question of you're really saying, should we then, you know, just stand back and let Islamists, whatever their agenda, come to power, I think is the implication of your question. And I have a couple answers. I don't disagree, by the way, with anything Frank said. I think people have the right to be wrong. They don't have the right to be wrong in ways that hurl missiles down unprovoked on innocent civilian communities in neighboring countries. So there's that. I think that if we're going to promote democracy, support democratic development around the world, we have an obligation to, allow countries to make choices and to be ready to live with choices politically that they don't like, and to have the faith in democracy that people will ultimately learn and that democracy is a self-correcting process. That is my great faith in democracy. My great concern about Islamists, which I think we have no way to evaluate at this point, is the lack of clarity on their ultimate aims. And, you know, I just participated in a press conference yesterday that announced an open letter that has been sent to President Obama and his administration, urging the Obama administration to continue to try to, I better find my verbs now, foster, encourage, I forget what word we use, but I confess it might have been promote, democracy in the Middle East, and to be ready to start talking with Islamist political actors and parties and, you know, let the process move forward. But we don't all agree here on what happens after that. And I am more skeptical than some of my colleagues with whom I signed that letter about the ultimate intentions of some of these parties. And none of them have ever come to power. The feast didn't come to power in Algeria. We never got a test of what Hamas would have done over time in Palestine if it had ruled indefinitely, in terms of whether they would have allowed sufficient political pluralism and electoral neutrality so that the correction could have been made at a later date. And I just think we need to be vigilant about that and mindful of that problem. On Afghanistan, I can't exceed what Frank said. If we don't deal with effective economic and social delivery, we're not going to turn the country around and enable people like yourselves to turn it around. And I have to be very candid here and say if corruption is not reduced in Afghanistan, then it isn't going to happen either. And there needs to be more of a rule of law and effective governance within the country. And then at some point we're going to have to deal with the drug trade. Everything is interconnected here. On the bribery problem, Hilton, I don't think we're going to get to a point where we can abandon the use of aid as, well, let's say a reward for geopolitical services rendered. But, you know, Mort Halpern had a very good idea in this book he co-authored a few years ago called The Democracy Advantage, which is, let's separate that out and say, look, we're going to have to live in the real world. We're going to have to offer aid to some countries whose governments we won't approve of because we have strategic relationships and needs with them. Let's understand that's a separate type of assistance that's being offered. And otherwise, as Frank said, take the economic and political development functions and rather than integrate them more deeply into the State Department, which is to politicize them, which I think is a huge mistake, give them the insulation, autonomy, and professionalism to really pursue development.
The only thing I'll add quickly before going on to the next question is the project intentionally did not focus on any individual region or country, so I don't have anything in particular to add on Palestine or Afghanistan, except for one thing, which is in the interviews we conducted, there was no single question that I think there were more factual disputes about than the role of the Bush administration in speeding up, facilitating, holding the Palestinian elections. If you were inside the administration, you basically said, we were being asked by the Palestinians to hold the elections. How could we possibly say no? For those we interviewed outside the administration, they accused the administration of basically making a massive mistake by forcing, pushing, encouraging the Palestinians to hold the elections. So there is a factual question about what the role of the U.S. government was in the timing of the Palestinian elections that I think needs to be clarified for people to get on the same page about the policy lessons to be taken away from it, because there is right now factual disagreement on what happened in the U.S. government's role in that process.
Should we take all six of these? So
yeah, let me do that because now you want to get out of here, sure.
Yeah, I have to. It's Mark Naterno, Interactivity Founder. I'm going to have to leave almost as soon as I have to pick up my kid. But I was struck, Larry, when you were talking about you have to get the institutions right
first. Otherwise, you're not going to get anything else right. And I've always thought of democracy as being a means towards an end and not an end in itself. And it strikes me that all of the institutions that we have, and we can discuss what are the institutions that go with democracy, but all of them can be used for diametrically opposite purposes than the purposes for which they were conceived and created. I mean, they can all be manipulated. You talked about them being, in some sense, how we can make them insulated from politics. I'm not sure that we have any here that are such, why we should expect to have any place else. And so it strikes me that the real difficult thing to do, I would think, is not so much the creation of the institutions as what some people call the changing of the hearts and minds of the people who are actually going to be operating them, so that they're not inclined to try to manipulate them. You know, some people, when you have institutions, the first thing that they begin to think about is how to get around them. And it strikes me that perhaps not even supporting democracy, or let alone promoting it, as sometimes we do as an end in itself, we should think more carefully about the sorts of things that we really do want to promote. What are they? And maybe in some cases, in some places, using democracy might not be the best way to get at them. So that's my comment. Got to pick up my kid.
Thanks.
My name is Wendell Ballou, and I represent an organization of Islamic charities that operate mostly in the Middle East. I'd like to go back to one of the first points that you raised, and that is that for this to work, the U.S. has to restore its image as an example of democracy. The Committee of Eminent Jurists released a report earlier this month that talks about how far, in the name of national security, some of the basic institutions and practices of democracy have been eroded. In my area of experience, I've seen the impact on civil society, that initiatives taken in the name of national security have substantially diminished the ability of civil society to operate, not just Islamic organizations, but very mainstream Western organizations. Perhaps the most difficult area for U.S. policy to work is, I think, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where the U.S. is seen, perhaps rightly, perhaps wrongly, as being one-sided. And that is seen as a counterexample to our talk about democracy, the recent experience of Chas Freeman, which Joe Klein called an assassination, is being widely discussed and seen as an example of how the U.S., despite the election of Barack Obama, is really not on the level about this.
Hi, Rob Henderson with Northern Virginia Community College, but I'm a veteran of CSIS and the IRI. I want to congratulate Alex and CSIS on getting back to some basics in terms of strategic theory. In 1978 and 79, a guy named Mike Samuels, who I think is in the audience, mobilized a stalwart committee, including people like Mel Laird and Senator Brooke from Massachusetts and Joe Sisko and a number of others, to think about the strategic implications of the non-security components of U.S. national security policy. Now, that is a cumbersome title, but I think you can look it up in your archives, because there is a little report that Brent Scowcroft helped put together at the end that laid a lot of the intellectual groundwork for some of the NED and some of the other initiatives that came out. My point is very simply that at that time, the question was not a strategic one in terms of resources. You know, what do you do in a resource-shrinking environment to support democratic change? It's how do you fight the Soviets more cost-effectively on the ground in some of these transitional societies? Well, the NED wasn't an arm of U.S. foreign policy. The NED was a promotion device, a support device, that could strengthen from counterpart institution to counterpart institution to achieve multipliers in impact that the U.S. government simply can't get there with. And it just has its skill, knowledge, practice on the ground in the hands of people who know how to use it. When Frank mentioned, you know, you don't want the Republican Institute distributing condoms, I had to laugh, because that's probably a very good idea not to. But the idea that you don't want the people who are distributing condoms to benefit from the voter registration data which is very precise, is absolutely generic, and something that they would desperately need to know in terms of numbers of people, density per population, voting age, sexually active, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's really good data. You do want that kind of stuff to be shared. So all I would do is just encourage people as they think back through some of these basics to look at the multipliers, that, because it's a lot more cost-effective to support emergent democratic forces than it is to go in and clean up failed states. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, I'm Yava Vilutida, graduate student at Democracy and Government Program at Georgetown. I'm currently writing master's thesis on democracy promotion, or I may change title to support strategies. And I have a question. When you look at U.S. democracy support to Eastern European countries like Ukraine, Moldova, or Belarus, or when U.S. supports or promotes democracy there, what do you think are they promoting? Thank you.
Yanghuan Keel is my name, and at Georgetown University as a visiting scholar. Dr. Fukuyama, in your presentation, you said that the Lee Kuan Yew horse is not ridden by world leaders, especially in the Middle East. So my question is it Hu Jintao or some Chinese leader like Deng Xiaoping or whoever else in the future would be one such horse rider? I say that because this morning there was a CSIS panel on this topic, China's soft power and the implications for the United States. And then the question was confucianism and democracy. That argument came up. I know you wrote an article and citing Samuel Huntington, who said that Confucian democracy is a contradiction, although democracy in Confucian society may not. In my own work, I addressed the South Korean case of defining it as a post-Confucian society, and the democracy so far has been working. So I'd like to ask you to give some your opinion of what China is doing or not doing.
I'm going to have to ask this will be the last question just so we can get to comments from the panel and then get out of here.
All right. Thank you. My name's Sam Green. I'm at National Defense University. My question has, I think, some similarities with the gentleman earlier who had to go pick up his kids. I don't. but it's, and I think most explicitly Professor Diamond talked about this, there's a question about the relationship between assistance and improving governance. And at least to me, implicit in the presentation is the idea that democracy assistance and other development assistance can in fact improve the performance of governance. My question is, how does this happen, under what circumstances, and are there times when democracy assistance will in fact not be able to improve governance and may in fact worsen it? Thank you.
Larry, do you want to start this time?
Okay, a few things very briefly. Number one, I don't agree that democracy is merely a means to an end. I think it's also an end in itself. It's a normative view. That's mine. Secondly, I don't agree that the most – I'm sorry that our friend here had to go. I don't think the most difficult thing to do is to change hearts and minds. I think it may be actually to create institutions that really work and are effective. Now, it's such a chicken and egg problem. It's hard to know. But let me put it this way. I've thought about this problem for 30 years because that's how long I've been going to Nigeria. And I can tell you, you're not going to end corruption in Nigeria or significantly curtail it by changing hearts and minds. You're going to do it by creating strong institutions that generate a different set of incentives, and the hearts and minds will change, or I will say behavior will change as a result. So without strong institutions and incentives, you're just not going to change behavior. Yeva, I'm not sure what U.S. support is doing in Ukraine or Belarus, simply because I'm not following it that carefully, but I think they're very different strategies. In Ukraine, our effort is to try and do what I've been talking about, which is support a new democracy, enable it to work, enable it to govern better. The problem is that the politicians have to get their act together, too, and they've clearly not done so in Ukraine, where the divisions among within the Democratic camp and just pure, you know, ineffective performance has been very crippling. Whereas in Belarus, we're trying to keep the flame of freedom and political pluralism alive amidst a regime that's really trying to completely stifle and crush it. On the final question or intervention, I think it's a very shrewd one, actually. And I think we have learned that when you pour substantial amounts of development assistance, including political development assistance, into efforts to try and improve or strengthen or modernize state institutions like legislatures, judiciaries, or so on, and there's no real political will to have those institutions perform in the ways that, you know, would be consistent with effective democracy, then you're going to waste your money. I mean, there's just a vast literature on rule of law assistance that shows that if you spend a lot of money to modernize courts, build modern court facilities, computerize law libraries, train pay judges better, and you don't have, at the same time, political modernization to increase the independence and professionalism of the judiciary, what you're going to get is a better trained, better housed, better computerized, and better paid, but no less corrupt or politically pliant judiciary, and that's not going to do much for democratic development. So having in place political leaders and state leaders in various sectors who really are ready to make use of the assistance to create modern and effective institutions, I'd say we have learned is a very important condition for this aid being effective. And this is why I'm such a strong believer in the selectivity principle that underlies the Millennium Challenge account, because I do think there is some intriguing initial evidence that it is helping to generate the political incentives or the political will to take these challenges seriously.
Well, I'll just say something briefly about Ukraine and China. I don't want to make this accusation. I don't really know enough to really make this accusation, so I'll make it as a suggestion. But it does seem to me that after the Orange Revolution, the United States kind of breathed a sigh of relief and said, good, it's done, you know, and did not follow up with a really big program to help Ukraine consolidate democracy, including with these feckless leaders. Like Yushchenko's got like 2% popularity right now because of mistakes he's made. And so it does seem to me that if we had been much more engaged and we had not taken for granted that Ukraine was a successful democracy but had really poured a lot of time and effort into helping them actually consolidate, maybe they wouldn't be in quite as much trouble. On China, that's an interesting question. I don't think there's a as I've argued in that article, I mean, I don't really think, you know, there's a lot of political traditions that support strong centralization. But I, you know, since other Confucian societies have democratized, I don't see that there's an insuperable obstacle. I think the real obstacle right now is just a kind of economic one, which is that there's so much inequality in China right now that the elites in China feel that if they democratize in the short run, it's going to unleash all these demands for redistribution. It's going to kill the goose that's been laying this golden egg, and they don't want to do it. And therefore, I would say that, Hu Jintao may not be Lee Kuan Yew, but if you had the option of, you know, pushing to kind of destabilize that regime in hopes that it'll become a democracy, I wouldn't be in favor of that. I think they should, you know, kind of leave well enough alone, because I do think in time there will be pressure in China for more democracy, but I just think that the conditions aren't really right for a
you know, well institutionalized, stable, you know, democratic system there right now. Yeah. Well, let them try. I mean, I don't know who's going to.
With that, I'm going to close the session partially in the interest of getting Larry out of here. Let me just close with two sets of thanks. One is to both Larry and Frank and Mike McFaul in his absence. It's not always the case that you get to work with very bright people who are a pleasure to work with in Washington, and this was certainly the case with these three authors as well as the rest of the advisory committee. The second is that Matt Owens, I think, has slipped out of the back. Matt was the guy that made all the gears run on this trip, so if you see him on the way out, please thank him for his help in putting this together in a what was essentially a very wide set of people in a year-long project, and thank you all for coming. Okay.